This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, is the U.S. empire coming apart at the seams? A Black political analyst says, yes, it is. And Americans think they are the nicest, most generous people in the world, even as they bomb a great portion of the planet. But a new book shows that American niceness is a mask and even a weapon.
But first, President Donald Trump shocked the U.S. military and imperial establishment with his decision to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria and to remove half of American military personnel from Afghanistan. The Black Alliance for Peace welcomed Trump's withdrawal. Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party 2016 candidate for vice president, is the lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace.
Well, I think that the immediate impact is that the U.S. is now attempting to realign itself with the norms and standards of international law. I think the public has to be made aware of or be reminded of the fact that the U.S. physical occupation of Syria was, in fact, an illegal occupation. The fact that the U.S. was engaged in military actions should have opened up the same question regarding the authorization for that activity in Syria that was raised regarding the activity of U.S. forces assisting the Saudi forces in Yemen. But of course, that was not raised in terms of the World Powers Act. So this decision on the part of the Trump administration is one that should be welcome. And I think that the real analysis should be on what is in fact really in play with that decision. And I raise that, Glenn, because you know, there are these ongoing negotiations, conversations, if you will, between the Russians, the Syrian government, the Iranians, regarding what role various forces, both invited and others like the U.S., will be playing in that country. So I'm curious to know that right after what appeared to be a negotiation in which Iranian and Iranian-backed militias agreed to begin a process of withdrawing their forces. We find this Trump announcement. I'm curious to know more about what is really going on in the background of these conversations.
Now, certainly Donald Trump, who does not speak the language of international law, will not frame this withdrawal, if it really does occur, in that kind of fashion. But it is an acquiescence to international norms.
It's, I think, a recognition of a situation that, from his point of view, and in fact, the point of view of others in the military intelligence complex, that the situation in Syria was really untenable for U.S. forces. You know, the way it's being projected is that there was some kind of common sense consensus on the part of the military intelligence establishment that the U.S. had to engage in a permanent occupation or have a permanent presence in Syria. Well, that's not really the case. There have been a number of voices that suggested that Syria was, in fact, a quagmire, and that the U.S. needed to find a way to extricate itself from that quagmire before it was too late. You know, we're looking at a situation where the U.S. has been trapped in Afghanistan for now 17 years. So this idea that this is something that is irresponsible, this is something that's being pushed by liberal Democrats, but it's something that, again, we need to look at more seriously because there is a basis for the U.S. getting out. We know that the Trump administration wants to refocus its attention in Asia. but they've been preoccupied with the ongoing conflicts in so-called Middle East and the whipped up hysteria with Russia, which has prevented them from making the kind of pivot, if you will, to Asia that we know he wanted to do from the very beginning of this administration.
So we may be seeing the U.S. out of Syria, but the Black Alliance for Peace is calling for U.S. out of Africa, a dismantling of AFRICOM.
We are calling for a real withdrawal from Syria because we want to make sure that, in fact, happens. We believe that it should happen because it is in alignment with international law. We want to see the U.S. out of Syria as we want to see the U.S. out of Iraq and out of Afghanistan. We want to see the closure of these aggressive foreign U.S. bases across the planet and specifically in Africa. We have said very clearly that our concern with closing down U.S. foreign bases in Africa and shutting down the Africa campaign, the African structure, that is, a command structure, is in alignment with our concern with and our objective to deal with the issue of global demilitarization, that we're not going to be able to address the collective challenges of humanity as long as we have a situation where one state or a collection of states led by the U.S. are able to continue to push an agenda of militarism and war that has the consequence of wasting precious resources and lives and polluting the environment, we're not going to be able to address the serious issues that face us collectively as long as that agenda is not seriously opposed morally and politically by the people of the planet.
John Bolton, President Trump's national security advisor, seems to want the United States to dig deeper in Africa, not just militarily, but commercially and through investment. And he's declared war, in effect, on China's presence in Africa. He says that the Chinese have attempted to gain a competitive advantage over the United States by unscrupulous means.
Well, again, this is part of that agenda, that basically all of the supposed norms of capitalist competition that we always knew was BS are being exposed to what they really are, that basically this is predatory capitalism and in its finest, if you will, and that instead of the U.S. being in a position to compete with the Chinese in economic terms, they are saying that they're going to turn back Chinese economic advancements in Africa by using military means. So, and in the middle, caught, of course, as always, are the African states and the African people. So this position articulated by Bolton is really a continuation of the positions of both the Obama administration and before his administration, the Bush administration, in terms of their emphasis not just on commercial ties. That's been sort of the surface position, but their commitment to using what they believe to be their real strength, and that is the military ties. If they were concerned about strengthening the commercial relations between the U.S. and various African states, well, they would have done that quite some time ago. But instead, they pursued policies that only resulted in serious debt peonage on the part of these African states. There was no serious investment in infrastructure that went beyond just extractive activities by U.S. multinational corporations. There was nothing that was offered to these African states that really would result in any real autonomous economic development until they gained some degree of leverage as a consequence of the emergence of the Chinese and the Chinese now pursuing their own national interests by developing stronger commercial ties with these African states. That gave these African states the leverage they needed to begin to not only acquire some degree of greater investment using Chinese capital, but also it put them in stronger positions vis-a-vis not only the U.S., but various European nations and European multinational corporations. So why it's very complicated. And we know that these states have their own particular national interests. It, again, is reflective of the new realities that the U.S. finds itself in globally, economically. And their response has been not to try to engage in normal economic activity, but to use what they have, which is their overwhelming military advantage to advance the interests of their elites.
Yes, through AFRICOM, which has relationships with almost every country in Africa and which uses the bases of these various African militaries for U.S. purposes, the United States appears to think that it has the leverage to pressure these governments to scale back their involvement with the Chinese. But as you said, it is their involvement with Chinese capital that has given these countries options that they did not have before. So these African countries that have this U.S. military presence, they have a choice to make if the United States pursues this aggressively anti-Chinese line.
They have to make some choices, and they will make choices, especially as we see more and more opposition from African people to these military-to-military agreements between these various African countries and the U.S. I'll point to, as just one example, the agreement between the U.S. and Ghana that was struck a few months ago. There was significant political opposition, including street demonstrations, because once the details of the agreement became known, where, in essence, the Ghanaian government was turning over operational control of their own bases to the U.S., including the U.S. controlling the airspace and acres of land around these bases, so that these became, in essence, no-go zones for the people of Ghana. People were outraged, and there was real opposition. You know, so we see this, we saw this in Ghana, and we see it in other countries also, that these African states are going to not only have to deal with the pressure from the U.S., but even more significantly, pressure from their own people if they engage in these kinds of neo-colonial relationships. So we believe, that is the Black Alliance of Peace, that if we are building relations with organizations on the ground in Africa to oppose AFRICOM, that eventually these various states will heed the opinion of their own populations and begin to reject this militarization of their societies by the U.S.
But of course, with these intimate military-to-military relationships that the United States has forged in Africa, where many thousands of not just African soldiers, but their families have had their health care provided by the United States, this always creates the potential for regime change in those countries that buck the U.S., or where the civil society tries to buck the U.S.
You're absolutely correct, and that's part of the argumentation that we make with civil society groups in Africa, that these relationships, and I think they understand that these relationships are relationships being established that help to undermine the struggles for democracy in a number of these African countries, because a number of these African countries with the strongest ties to the U.S. are African countries in which been a break on democratic development, if you will, that these countries have basically decided that they're going to cooperate with the U.S. to the detriment of their own people. So we recognize, as they recognize, that these bases become bases for domestic repression, and therefore it becomes another reason why those bases and those relationships have to be rejected. And they can be rejected, too, as more and more people in the U.S. understand the terms of the relationship, that basically you're not going to have normal economic development, normal, quote unquote, normal politics, as long as you have this disproportionate ability to influence repressive politics on the part of the U.S. in these various countries. So the struggle is a struggle for democracy, if you will, also on the African continent.
and the death of 6 to 7 million Congolese would have been inconceivable without the intimate United States relationship with the perpetrators of that genocide, the governments of Rwanda and Uganda.
Exactly. The Holocaust in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is a graphic example of what we've been talking about. The consequences of these wars of resources being waged by the U.S. and waged using military means, that this predatory capitalism, I don't even want to call it capitalism, but this predatory activity to strip the resources of a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo of its natural resources, and the resistance on the part of various peoples to that has resulted over the years in millions, 6 million people and more who have had their lives snuffed out as a consequence. And those lives would not have been eliminated without the active participation support of these various countries, and specifically Rwanda and Uganda, cooperating with the U.S. in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so this is another example of why these states have to be able to be put on notice that if they continue to cooperate with these alien forces that are resulting in the loss of life of African people and the destruction of African societies, that they're going to be called out, and that this has to be the basis of the positions of African people in North America, in the U.S., and in our opposition to what's happening with U.S. policy vis-a-vis Africa. We can no longer allow ourselves to be silent while these kinds of activities are taking place, in which millions of African people are losing their lives with no real resistance movement on the part of African people in the U.S., and in particular, the people who are supposed to be the representatives of Black people in the U.S., who are members of the Congressional Black Caucus. There has to be some degree of accountability. And therefore, that is why we've been organizing this campaign to bring attention to what is happening on the African continent, to help people understand the relationship between the U.S. And these African nations and the consequences of that relationship.
There was a time when the Congressional Black Caucus could be counted on to say, at the very least, that the United States should have more involvement in Africa, which was a questionable proposition back then. But now we hear almost nothing about Africa from the Congressional Black Caucus.
And the little bit that we do hear, it's in line with the more neoliberal economic policies that were pushed by both the Bush and the Obama administration through their African Growth and Responsibility Act that was no more than a neoliberal strategy to further tie these African economies to the U.S. economy and to encourage things like entrepreneurship. So no, there has not been much attention on the African continent. And that's one of the objectives of our campaign, is to ask or to demand that the Congressional Black Caucus, now that they are going to be in positions where they can call hearings, to investigate, to call hearings on what has been the impact of the African U.S. Africa Command in Africa. What has been the real consequences of U.S. economic policies on the African continent? So we want to have accountability, because that, in fact, has to be part of our responsibility as African people in the U.S. at the center of empire.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
The Democrats and others in the U.S. War Party act as if Donald Trump is the cause of the U.S. domestic and international crisis. But Dr. Anthony Monteiro, the Du Boisian scholar based in Philadelphia, says Trump didn't create the acute crisis that U.S. imperialism is undergoing, that it's been a long time coming.
I think what we're looking at is the beginning of the end of a world order that was hatched pretty much after World War II, but really took on its most vicious form in the 1980s. And certainly after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that's what we're talking about. I'm not the only one that would put it that way. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, has a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine. He's talking about what happens when a world order falls apart. And near the end, he has a subsection titled, How to Manage the Deterioration. I've mentioned before in Truth Dig, the essay by Gareth Porter, could Trump represent the end of the U.S. empire? And it's all over the place, this type of thinking. And I think for my part, I kind of saw this going back to 2016, where the election of 2016 could be read, and I think accurately read, as a referendum on war and austerity, as brought to us by the Republicans of George W. Bush and the Democrats of Barack Obama. Well, we can even go further back to Bill Clinton. So it was a referendum on that. And it was because I saw that election in that way, I saw it as very probable, in spite of the polls, that Donald Trump could win. I think it could also have been read as a referendum on the possibility of world war, a la Hillary Clinton and that side of the ruling class ledger, as opposed to civil war. And what I see, and this is not just in the United States, it's sweeping the entire Euro-American world, is retreat from empire and its cost based upon a popular uprising of those who have to pay the cost of empire, and that is everywhere from the yellow vest in France to the Brexiteers in Britain to the Trump supporters in the United States. And I think that the choice being made on the street and among popular broad masses of the population is we want to fight the political battle in our own nations rather than war with Russia or China that could easily become a global conflagration.
Yes, we see the yellow vests in France and their list of demands, which is a very broad one. Basically, the question is, what's wrong with France? And their answer is just about everything. But that same kind of verdict could be delivered on the regime in all of the developed capitalist countries, all of which Absolutely. Are wedded to endless austerity.
That's right, an empire. You know, the cost of empire is carried on the backs of ordinary people. And if you go to city by city, the increases of taxes and fees that affect working people, while 10-year tax abatements for the sake of downtown development and gentrification are given to the rich. And then, of course, the ongoing military budgets and the costs of war, at least close to $6 trillion over the last, let us say, 18 years in the Middle East. And this goes on. And the populations of the so-called advanced capitalist countries are becoming poorer. I often talk about Philadelphia, which in a lot of ways is ground zero for urban poverty. Philadelphia is the poorest of the top 10 largest cities in the country. But it's also the most hungry. Over the last 2 years here in Philadelphia, we've seen an increase of 22% in hunger. Over the last 10 years, hunger has increased by 300% in the city of Philadelphia. And an interesting part of this, that over the last 2 years, the most dramatic, the most rapid increase in poverty has been among white working people. So there is a popular uprising, a crisis of legitimacy, to use Arthur Schlesinger's language, the collapse of the vital center. And thus, when the center collapses, and as they would put it, the extremes become normal, that looks like civil war. Now, it's not going to be like 1861 to 1865, but we are talking about a political civil war, which shows no signs of abating, and I believe will reshape the entire politics of at least this country for decades to come.
Bernie Sanders speaks a kind of mild language of class conflict and talks a lot about austerity, but very little to none about empire.
Well, that's true. And for that reason, he is untrustworthy. This Bernie Sanders form of social imperialism is less palatable than Donald Trump. So-called right-wing populism. You see, the question is, Bernie Sanders and them are trying to talk out of both sides of their mouths, as is a big part of the left who have become blinded by their own dogmatism. What Sanders is saying, we can have empire and war and solve the problems of poverty and lack of health care and other things domestically. I would just remind Bernie and his followers of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, war is the enemy of the poor. So I think that form of social democratic leftism will have a very difficult time in this turbulent moment of popular unrest and, again, this huge historic crisis of legitimacy, where the people are angry and deeply angry at all of the elites, be they in the House of Representatives or the media or academia or the corporate boardrooms. The population is angry. It's about to take matters into its own hands, I would say.
In terms of the option of world war, on the weaponized dollar front, the United States caused the arrest of a top official of China's biggest electronics firm, and there's been a tit-for-tat. What's the level of conflict here?
I think it's a high level of conflict, and I think that is going to have to be resolved quickly, indeed. China is a major competitor. The two economies are about the same size at this point, and certainly by 2020, 2021 or thereabouts, China will be the largest economy in the world. But, you know, that to me does not tell the whole story, because a lot of the popular unrest that is sweeping the West, the Euro-American world, China is not exempt from, nor is India. I think that we're looking at an end to the neoliberal world order. China cannot be its champion without austerity upon its own people. And then, of course, the normal process of leveling, which comes as a result of another recession. We've been 10 years in this current cycle, and I think it's coming to an end. But here we have, as I think RT reported, $187 trillion of debt in the world. Even know how you get your head around that, or how you manage that, or what that means in the midst of a recession. Will that debt bring the global financial system down in the way it was almost brought down in 2008?
That figure is about twice as much as the world gross product. That is,
yes,
the value
is.
Of the,
right.
All the goods and services made by all the people of the earth.
That's right. The $80 trillion or so, that is the wealth, the measure of the wealth, income, and other things in the global economy, is less than one half of what the debt is. Now, of course, that is a measure. This debt is a measure of the power of the financial oligarchy, this 0.1% of the human population who control almost everything.
Yes, that is the way that we should see it. These are seized assets, or assets that the financial class has claims on.
That's right. And you know something, Glenn? I don't know that the world system in its modern iteration has ever experienced. The type of contradictions that we have in the world today, and to put it another way, the crisis is comprehensive and total. It is affecting every area of human life, especially in the West. It is not just economic. It's social. It's civilizational. It is affecting the human personality, the psychology of individuals. This is a total crisis, and ultimately it can only be resolved through a change of systems. Now, will that occur? It is hard to say. Could we enter into a prolonged dark ages? Yes, very probably. Or could it be something similar to 1789 in France, where popular uprising overthrew the old regime, and then political parties emerged out of that popular uprising, rather than what some of us always thought, that the popular masses would be led to revolutionary change by a vanguard? That was probably a romanticizing of the Russian Revolution. But certainly the popular masses are not going to go back home anytime soon. They have glimpsed something of their potential power, and I think they're going to look for multiple ways to use it against the elites and their class and race enemies.
Well, just looking at the debt situation, we see a scenario where a financial class, which became even more consolidated during the last recession and then was flooded with free money by the central banks, the Federal Reserve here in the United States and the central banks in Europe, flooded with money, which it then used to further indebt the rest of society. There seems to be, to put it simplistically, a choice to be made. You can allow the financial class to foreclose on the rest of society, or the rest of society can foreclose on them.
That's right. That's a wonderful way to put it. And I think that those are the options we're faced with. And of course, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, the Democrats, and certainly the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama side of the Democrats, are the party of world war. That's what the Ukrainian coup d'etat led by the U.S. was all about. That is what Hillary's proposal for no-fly zone over Syria was all about, even though the Russians were already there. And that's what their proposed intensification of military action on the Korean Peninsula was all about. They were threatening world war. That has been stepped back somewhat. But no one can ultimately predict totally what outcomes are. But this retreat back into domestic struggle over poverty, austerity, jobs, infrastructure, be it in France or be it in Italy or be it in the United States, is from the standpoint of the people, the alternative to war, which is in a lot of ways the export of contradictions abroad. I think what we're looking at is the opposite. And I think the way I read what people are saying and the mass sentiment, that people are saying they don't want war, they want a settlement of their problems with the ruling elites of their own countries. And in this country, it's very obvious to me.
Yes, it is really clear, and the polls show it, that the public isn't enthusiastically buying into this Russiagate scenario, right, which is, of course, ginned up by the Democrats. But nevertheless, we see Nancy Pelosi sticking with a pay-as-you-go policy that effectively would stop any Democratic assault on austerity, while at the same time making those "let's get tough with Russia" noises.
Yeah, and you know, the Nancy Pelosi's or the Donald Trump's will not decide this matter. It is the people who will. And I think it was the people who decided the 2016 election, in spite of what the pollsters were saying. And I think in a very interesting way, 2018 was not the blue sweep that was predicted or was hoped for, which means that the people remain where they were in 2016. The elites are totally unpopular, hate it, and that includes the banks and the financial oligarchy. It includes the academics, the professional. I mean, just the whole system of rule in this country is in crisis. And there is no center to bring, well, maybe the politicians can come together, but at the level of the masses, there's no center that they are satisfied with. So here we are.
So here we are, and where is that?
I think we're on the cusp of what might be a complete collapse of the system. We've mentioned $187 trillion of debt among the mainly the advanced capitalist countries. We mentioned austerity and growing poverty. It might be as high as 50% of the American people, the American working class in particular, live in poverty. I think we're looking at a systemic collapse. The neoliberal order is now unraveling. The unraveling of the neoliberal order brings with it the unraveling of American empire. I've often called it a imperial retreat. This is where we are. Now, of course, is there a left of any value in the United States? I would answer that by saying no. Is it possible to build a left under these conditions? And I would say yes. And I would say it is necessary and vital if there is to be a shortening of a period of chaos and the movement towards a resolution of this great contradiction that is Western capitalism at this time.
That was Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Monteiro speaking from Philadelphia.
Americans, especially white Americans, seems to think that they are among the nicest people in the world, both personally and as a nation. Most of the world does not share that opinion. Dr. Carrie Brayman, a professor of English at Buffalo State University in New York, has written a book on the subject. It's called American Niceness, A Cultural History. Brayman says smiling faces can be very dangerous.
I think there's an aspect to niceness that is deeply antisocial. It can create boundaries and walls, ways to keep people at bay. So this happens in sort of everyday confrontations with homelessness, for example. And you wonder to what extent is the philanthropic gesture of a dollar or something a way to keep the disenfranchised, the homeless, the beggar at bay. And, you know, William Dean Howells has a wonderful encounter, a sidewalk encounter from the 1890s, in which he sees a beggar and says, should I give him a quarter or more? Will he be thrifty with the money I give him or not? And this, like, banal gesture on the sidewalk becomes this moment of moral interrogation full of liberal guilt and all that. So niceness really is something that seems superficial and cliche, like have a nice day. But as you think about it and reflect on it more, it has all sorts of uses that in many ways masquerade and just or compensate for justice. I call it a democratic form of behavior because it gives the sense of social egalitarianism while at the same time not allowing for and not permitting real egalitarianism. So it is a compensatory dynamic that goes back, I argue, well into the origins of the country. And if, you know, Tocqueville in the 1830s writes about the wealthy speaking to the poor on a regular basis and not being patronizing or anything like that, but taking a genuine interest in the poor. And through these little kindnesses, Tocqueville says, the wealthy are able to mollify a class society. So it's not as if nice behavior eradicates inequality, but it mollifies it. And Tocqueville saw that very early on.
Yes, lots of people think that Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world, is very nice because he spends a few billions here and there doing nice things.
Yes, absolutely. And philanthropy has that function, right? It kind of keeps the status quo intact while giving a sense of munificence to others. So a billionaire like Bill Gates gets a kind of PR boost from being so generous, while at the same time that generosity is on its own terms. And it's really interesting because now you're seeing more and more of an institutional critique, like why can't the billionaires be taxed? And that philanthropy is actually perpetuating inequality rather than solving it. So I think what's fascinating right now is that you have this ongoing structural critique of we need to tax, not to depend on the kindness of strangers.
People who consider themselves pillars of the community and therefore very nice people often turn out to be guardians of the racial exclusivity of that community.
Absolutely. And I think this is why the term civility, I think, is such a complicated one and a loaded one. Because unlike niceness, civility has a real class connotation to it, like politeness. Who has the right to be civil and who doesn't? And to what extent is civility a way in which social custom in many ways protects the elite? There's a Charlie Rose episode from the 1990s in which Brooke Astor, the patrician, talks about knowing every name of the guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And she argues that niceness will get you farther in life. It's easier to be nice. And I just thought that was a quintessential expression of the American form of noblesse oblige, this kind of democratic persona of knowing the names of all the employees at the MoMA. And I think that's a quintessential example of the ways in which niceness has functioned historically in this country by the upper class through a kind of populist gesture of being able to speak to the lower classes.
I don't know if you call it civility or politeness or niceness, but I remember, and it grates on lots of black folks, how Southern white folks used to be described as so nice, so polite, so civil, and yet we black folks remember them as folks who can gather in the thousands to lynch people.
Yes. In fact, my second chapter is precisely on Southern niceness and the ways in which Southern niceness has been used or was used to legitimize U.S. slavery as a kinder and gentler form of slavery versus its Black Atlantic versions in the Caribbean. So that's a wonderful example to show how Southern niceness actually worked with American exceptionalism to show a gentler and kinder form of slavery. And I think the power of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel that came out in 1852, is precisely how she critiques slavery through the Shelbys, who are the nicest people living in Kentucky. And it was argued that Kentucky was where slavery was practiced at its most genteel versus Louisiana and Mississippi. So she takes the core, really the hub of Southern niceness, the Kentucky upper class and the Shelby family, to show that even when it's practiced among people who really believed in their own goodness, it is still an inhumane institution. And, you know, there were arguments in the 1850s about how can we reform slavery? Can slavery be adjudicated by, you know, no beating of slaves, no torturing of slaves? And I think, you know, and Dredd, so second novel about slavery, she argues that there really is no way to reform this institution. And Frederick Douglass also argued this before. It is founded on torture. So you can't have a nicer, kinder form of slavery by definition. And so much of the abolitionist critique of slavery involved this question of niceness and can it be made more humane?
And of course, the victims of this pathological niceness have their own responses. You've got a chapter on, this is an intriguing idea, the politics of the black smile.
Yes, there's a way in which the black smile and the Sambo figure and the figure of the happy slave has been absolutely essential to maintaining the Southern order and of sustaining U.S. slavery. And John Blasingame argued this a number of years ago of how Southern slavery depended on the Sambo figure. So the happy slave vindicates slavery by showing how the subaltern are consenting to their own enslavement. There is a way in which it endorses a kind of fantasy of consensual slavery through the slave smile. It was also in my research I found out that in slave auctions, slaves were often forced to smile on the auction block, particularly black women, because they would be seen as more likely. And that word from the early 19th century, likely, means amiable, but also attractive and docile. So the smile was a way of marketing, right, that you're not going to have an angry slave. You will be buying a more subservient slave. And it was a kind of mandated cheerfulness through threats in which the slave woman would be forced to smile. Again, that fantasy, that white Southern fantasy of consensual slavery. But I also argue that the slave smile was a form of deception. During the Civil War, there were spies for the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, that infiltrated the homes of Confederate generals and would look at the maps and report to the spy network in Richmond, Virginia, and elsewhere throughout the South about the future military campaigns of the Confederacy. So the slave smile there was a figure of subterfuge and a necessary tactic that really unraveled the South, because it showed that the quote unquote the Sambo face was absolutely a very effective way of undermining the South through spies and through Union spies. And those records were destroyed after the war to protect those Union spies. And so unfortunately I understand why that was done. It was absolutely necessary, but I think there was a fascinating history coming out of that story.
So when we examine the politics of the black smile, we can understand the derision that is sometimes attached by black people to the term nice Negro.
Absolutely. I mean, that is a real long history. And I've just been reading Jamil Hill's piece in The Atlantic saying, I wish the Obamas didn't always go so high in terms of their niceness to the Trumps at George Walker Bush's funeral. And this mandate for black niceness that we always have to go high, I think is a really important point. I go in my chapter 2, the same chapter I've been talking about, in which Charles Dickens and George Eliot write a review of Stowe's fiction and say, why do her black characters have to be so nice? Do you have to make black characters Christ-like in order to critique slavery? And there's a way in which Stowe absolutely understands that there was a limited effective range in which white authors could depict black characters because white readers would be threatened by black anger. So historically, I argue, black niceness was an absolute strategy to argue for black humanity, that likability was a way to vindicate black character. So rather than to fear blackness, why not invite people to befriend blackness? And Harriet Beecher Stowe, you have to be able to look at the black face, to look at Aunt Millie's eyes, to look at Uncle Tom's face as he's dying, and to see the smile on his face, which also matches little Eva's dying smile upon her face, showing a common humanity between both. So there's a way in which black niceness absolutely was the tool for human rights rhetoric in an abolitionist discourse of the 19th century. But there's also a flip side to it now, as I just noted with Jamil Hill's critique, why do the Obamas always have to be so polite, so kind, so forgiving?
Yes, one of the most powerful rhetorical tools that are used politically against black individuals, black politicos, is to call them angry black people.
Yes, exactly. And to refer to Jamil Hill's piece again, you know, in October, the video went viral of a white woman, Teresa Klein, falsely accusing 9-year-old Jeremiah Harvey of groping her in a Brooklyn deli. And when the surveillance film was shown and, you know, nothing happened between the two of them, only that Jamil's backpack brushed against Klein as he passed her, the nine-year-old boy afterward refused to apologize. And he said, she needs help. She's a sick woman. And people critiqued that young boy's lack of forgiveness. And I think, you know, Black anger needs to be expressed. And Black Lives Matter is a really important vehicle to show the power of Black anger when it's organized. And, you know, I do think that that anger is constructive and productive, and it is terrifying, I think, to the white imaginary because it elicits so much in terms of white guilt as well.
On the macro global level, white Americans think, they really believe that they're a good and caring nation, and that others take advantage of that innate American goodness. But the reality, of course, is, as Dr. King said, that the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world.
Absolutely. I think American exceptionalism, and, you know, Susie Hansen has talked about this in her Bar Forum, which is published alongside the one discussion of my book, talks about how the right and the left have embraced American exceptionalism. And what I'm arguing is that American exceptionalism is not just about military might and economic prowess, but also involves banal gestures like niceness, the handshake, the smile, the affect of amiability. And I believe that whiteness, and James Baldwin saw this too, in terms of innocence commits the crime, that niceness can function, and it has historically functioned within American exceptionalism as a form of disavowal, as a way to not own the violent history of genocide and enslavement and imperialism. And it's a form of the disavowal of domination, to quote George Shulman, the political theorist. And we need to shift, I want to argue, not from ignorance to knowledge. And I think this is what Baldwin is arguing, too. We need to go from innocence to acknowledgement, to recognition of the policies and the history of the U.S. government, because we know, but we don't want to know. And there's a way in which the interpersonal has been a way to disavow that structural and institutional history of violence. In my book, I argue how American niceness, including white niceness, is absolutely dependent on minority niceness. And I look at Aunt Jemima's smile and the way the figure of Aunt Jemima was embraced in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. So when you have Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass protesting that fair for the exclusion of African American writers and artists and inventors, but you have that same fair embracing Nancy Green as the first Aunt Jemima, making pancakes and recalling stories on the Kentucky plantation where she grew up. I mean, that shows you the way in which African-American niceness is very much part of this belief in America's own goodness. And in addition, Native American niceness, which is iconic in terms of Thanksgiving, where Native Americans gave generously to the starving pilgrims in 1621, you know, that idea of Indian giving is absolutely foundational to America's sense of its own benevolence and of its own goodness, that it's defined in and through subaltern niceness. And I just want to show how interconnected they all are in creating a kind of what I call a manifest cheerfulness, a nation unified not through indigeneity and a geist that's rooted in the soil because of the history of genocide. It's located in gestures. It's located in social conformity. And that's what defines a kind of lingua franca for the country, which includes white smiles, black smiles, and red smiles melded together. And that's the hegemonic form of American niceness. But I also want to argue for counter-narratives. I just finished reading Rudy Acuna's latest book on the assault on the Mexican-American memory, in which he says we have to keep counter-narratives alive. And I really want to emphasize that American niceness is a capacious category that also includes, you know, gestures of outrage. Washington Irving, for example, disgusted by General Jackson massacring the Creek Indians in Florida. And, you know, as one instance of that white outrage about human rights abuses. And there's a long history of outrage that, you know, continues today in the protests and the social movements that are interracial. And I think we need to take those seriously because this country has always been defined, I want to argue, by the twin figures of the nice and the nasty, right? You know, Jose Marti wrote in 1890s that every country is defined by its selfish and its generous people, and history determines which side wins.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.